Deer Park. Now, here's Dr. John McDougall.
And good morning. This is Dr. John McDougall joining you on the Northern California Radio Network. And a real pleasure today to have the guest I have with us. As a matter of fact, if you want to talk to this man, you better get on the lines early because the number is 707-270-1350 and 1-800-570-TALK. And those numbers are going to be hot today because we have one of the most famous doctors in the entire world on this show today. As a matter of fact, this is a winner of the 1924 gold medal and a man who's been, his books have been on the bookshelves of, I guess, every parent in the United States, certainly in many other countries also. I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Benjamin Spock. Dr. Spock?
Hello.
Nice to have you on the show with us today.
Well, thanks for asking me.
You're giving a conference down in Tennessee that says, the title is so intriguing, How Did Dr. Spock Get to Be 90 and Feel So Well?
Yes, that's my wife's, excuse me, that's my wife's special subject, and she likes to demonstrate all the health measures that she uses. She's got me by the ankles and is keeping me from sliding toward the sick bed or toward death or toward the grave.
How old is your wife?
She is going to be 50.
Oh, well, that says something right there, doesn't it?
Yes.
So she's very interested in keeping you as healthy as possible, to say the least. Do you have any? We just have a minute or so before we go to the break, but any strong tips on how we could get to be 90 and feel so good, too?
Do I have strong opinions?
Yeah. Do you have any just, you know, do you think diet's important, for example?
Oh, I think diet is extremely important, and I didn't used to think so. At first, we learned that fats, especially animal fats, dairy fats, are likely to produce arteriosclerosis, coronary heart disease. More recently, there's the macrobiotic diet, which is more drastic still. It isn't just a lack of fats, lack of sweets. It's lack of dairy products of all kinds, so that now I can't eat butter, can't eat all those delicious sauces that are made from butter. I can't eat.
Well, this sounds like a pretty tough wife that you have that's ruling the dinner table, Dr. Benjamin.
Very determined, very dedicated, and it's hard when somebody is dedicated to your welfare to say, but I'd rather not be so strict with the diet and maybe give up a few months of...
Well, we'll see about that. We'll see about that. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. My guest is Dr. Benjamin Spock. We're going to take a couple of minutes here if you'd like to talk to Dr. Spock. Many of you have lived by his message, so here's a chance to talk to him personally. 707-270-1350 or 1-800-570-TALK. I'll be back with you in just a moment.
Savings Bank and open a Market Advantage account today.
Member FDIC.
Good morning, this is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. If you want to have a chance to talk to Dr. Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor, then give us a call at 707-270-1350 or 1-800-570-TALK. And Dr. Spock has a new book that he's writing right now. It's called A Better World for Our Children. What more appropriate title, A Better World for Our Children? I'm sure he's got a lot of thoughts on that. But first, Dr. Spock, I'd like to take you back a little bit, and I want to find out how you got into medicine, which must have been 60, 70 years ago.
Oh, well, it was a long time ago. I went to medical school beginning in 1925 and got my degree in 1929. I think that the most immediate reason that I got interested in medicine was that I was a summer counselor at a crippled children's home, and I saw an orthopedic surgeon come out to this home and do an operation on a boy on his ankle, so that his leg would be more usable, and that gave me the idea, well, that would be good to be able to help children lead a happier or a healthier life. I think a more fundamental reason went back to the fact that I was the oldest of six children. The oldest child characteristically is identifies with the parents. And my mother loved babies. She wildly loved babies. And I remember when I was 9 years old and my brother was born, I changed a majority of his diapers, I think, and gave him a lot of bottles and rocked him to sleep in a baby carriage on the porch of the summer cottage where we vacationed. So between those two, I think it's that's the real explanation of how I got into medicine. I got in to be a pediatrician. I wanted to be a children's doctor.
Well, how did you get around to deciding that you were an expert enough and you'd accumulated enough of information so that you could write as the world's expert on baby health and raising children?
Well, the first time I was asked to write a book, it was 5 years after I started pediatric practice. I started pediatric practice at the bottom of the Depression in New York City in 1933. And I had a hard time, incidentally, making a living. They didn't need another pediatrician in New York City. Well, I lost track of what I was about to say.
Well, you were going to tell us how you got from a regular old pediatrician, Dr. Benjamin Spock, to a
I'd
famous...
I'd been in practice for 5 years,
yes.
And the publisher Doubleday came to me and said they'd like me to write a book for parents. And it wasn't that I was known. I was completely unknown, but I was the only pediatrician in New York, or in the United States for that matter, who'd had a psychological training. I'd had a residency in psychiatry, and then I'd had psychoanalytic training. I immediately said I don't know enough, and that wasn't modesty or pseudo-modesty. I really didn't think that I did know too many of the answers, because what I'd learned in theory from my psychoanalytic Freudian training didn't correspond in my mind at first with what mothers were telling me about their babies. Mothers were telling me, asking me, why does the baby want a thumb suck? And there was no, Freud didn't have an answer for, for that. Why is the baby resisting weaning from the bottle to the cup? Why is the baby resisting toilet training? Freudian concepts came near some of these things, but gave no practical answers. So that's why I said right away, I don't know the answer. I don't know enough answers to write a book. That was 5 years after starting practice. 5 years after that, 10 years after starting practice, pocketbooks came to me, and the editor who came was a sort of a jokester. He was really quite serious, but he approached things from a joking point of view, and he said, you know, the book that we'd like you to write doesn't have to be very good. He said, 25 cents a copy, and that was the price in the for the first few years. He said, we can sell 10,000 a year. Well, instead of being insulted by his telling me it doesn't have to be very good, I was very relieved, because if he'd said, we want this to be the best book that's ever been written for parents, I would have immediately backed away and said, oh, I can't guarantee anything like that. But if he says, even if it's not very good, they'll sell 10,000 a year, that appealed to the do-gooder in me, and I'm basically a do-gooder. So by the time I'd been 10 years in practice, I felt I knew a majority of the answers so well enough to put them down in a book. So that's how I got started.
Dr. Spock, our patients are often our best teachers. Are there any patients that you particularly remember that changed the way you thought about child care?
Well, I think that there were many things that I had to learn, and that I learned them from some of them from parents, and I learned some of them, a few of them, from other doctors. For instance, let me give you an idea of how ignorant the whole profession was about the psychological side of things. The commonest treatment for thumb sucking in an infant, and the doctor always said to the parents, "Oh, it's a bad habit. You should stop it as fast as you can." And what he would recommend was either painting nasty tasting stuff on the thumb, or enclosing both fists in aluminum mitts, or tying the poor baby's wrist to the sides of the crib. And anyway, my psychological training told me those are really harsh ways of going at something. What I need to find out is what causes thumb sucking, and is there any way of preventing it? And so,
well, let me hold you right there, and we'll find out what the cause of a thumb sucking is, according to Dr. Benjamin Spock. And if you'd like to talk to Dr. Spock, this is a rare opportunity. 707-270-1350 or 1-800-570-TALK. And Dr. Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor, will be back with you in just a few moments. Good morning, Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network, and we have Dr. Benjamin Spock. And the first question before we get to the thumb-sucking question is, Dr. Benjamin Spock, what did you win the Olympics for in 1924?
I was on the Yale rowing team, the eight-oared crew. We won the Olympic trials in the United States and went to the 1924 Olympic Games in Paris. And there we easily won the world championship. It was a bit of an anticlimax. It was harder to win the Olympic trials in the United States than it was to, to win the Olympics themselves on the Seine River in Paris.
Well, from the Olympics, let's go back to thumb sucking. If the solution is not to paint nasty tasting stuff on the thumb, what is the thumb sucking all about?
Well, I think that it starts as insufficient sucking satisfaction from breast or bottle, particularly bottle, and therefore one should be on the lookout, for instance, for if the baby begins to be able, as he gets stronger, to finish the bottle in 5 or 10 minutes instead of the 20 minutes that it used to take him. It's good to get new rubber nipples so that it'll take him 20 minutes again. That's one aspect. I think another aspect, of course, is that some babies don't suck their thumb at all, and if they aren't seeming to want to do more sucking, you don't have to do anything. But if they are searching for their thumb, that's the significant thing. I think that it's good to give them a pacifier, to substitute the pacifier for the thumb in the first couple of weeks of life. And then you can usually get rid of the pacifier at around 3 months of age.
Well, Dr. Spock, you brought it up, so let me ask it. Do you think there's any difference between breastfeeding and bottle feeding, or you think they're equally good?
Well, I think that breastfeeding is better from two points of view. One is the physical. We know that the baby who has been on the breast will have fewer gastrointestinal infections and fewer respiratory infections. In other words, he gets more immunity from his mother's milk. From a psychological point of view, I think it helps to bind the mother and the baby together, especially the mother with her first baby, to see how happy the baby is to be nursing at breast. and that he's getting all of his nourishment from her, gives the mother who hasn't learned a lot of self-confidence yet, it gives her a feeling of, I'm really important to this baby. And I think that's a crucial, very important thing for a mother, especially with her first baby, to learn that she can do something for him that nobody else can do.
Dr. Benjamin Spock, the greatest controversy I've seen you involved in, we'll get to some of the other controversies, the one that just happened in terms of, here, the most respected child doctor, baby doctor in the entire world stands up and says, cow's milk is not fit for children. How in the world did they get you to do that?
Well, I never said anything as drastic as that. This was a press conference called by a highly conscientious organization to point out some of the disadvantages of cow's milk. I, knowing that it would fill millions of parents with guilt if we said anything too drastic, was very careful. I only said two things. One is that it's better for babies to be breastfed, and the other one was that if a baby is going to be, when he's going to be changed over to cow's milk, it shouldn't be done at 6 months. You should wait until the baby's at least a year, because babies from a year on are much less likely to get allergies to cow's milk than younger babies. Now, some other people went further, talking about diabetes, for instance. If there's a suspicion that one of the factors in childhood diabetes is sensitivity to cow's milk. But I didn't say anything about that because that hasn't been proved yet, I think, therefore, not right to get parents worried, feeling guilty.
Well, let me ask you this: would it be any more right to get parents to feel guilty about not feeding cow's milk to children? In other words, what if a mother says, based on what I've heard so far, in other words, the allergy problem, the possibility of childhood diabetes, the anemia problems associated with milk, the constipation, the diarrhea, the fat, the lactose intolerance, the infection with various organisms, based on all that, I'd like to err on the side of not feeding my child cow's milk. Would that be something you would applaud, or do you think there's some hazards to that?
Well, the first obvious answer is to decide that ahead of time and to breastfeed the baby and to have to do it very carefully, thoroughly, and keep it up until a year of age. That's the first and the most natural way of avoiding these difficulties.
Well, does a two-year-old need cow's milk? Does a three-year-old need cow's milk? Does a five-year-old need cow's milk?
Well, they don't absolutely have to have milk. That's one of the things that's been discovered in recent years, is that green leafy vegetables, for instance, and other foods in general supply the protein and the calcium.
All right, well, let's just hold it right there because this very important subject we want to get into a little bit more. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network.
It's all about.
Dr. John McDougall with you, with Dr. Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor, and our engineer here, who was raised by the principles of Dr. Benjamin Spock, has a question I'd like to relay to you. Dr. Spock, we have a pretty famous situation going on here where a mother shot the accused child molester of her child here. Have you heard about that out here in our state?
I don't think I have.
Well, what happened, as I remember the story, I haven't followed very closely, as this man was accused of child molestation, and during the trial, the mother walked in and took a .45 and killed the man. That kind of a parent-child bonding relationship, do you think that's fairly typical of how the relationship be and the kind of reaction? What would you think of that reaction of that mother?
Well, I I think that any mother would be, or father would be, distressed if they find that the child has been molested. But I think that most people don't think that to shoot somebody dead is a way of solving the problem.
She has an awful lot of support, I'll tell you, in the community. They seem to think that what she did was a pretty reasonable thing. At least a lot of folks do.
Well, I can see why a lot of people would realize that they would be furiously angry, and to make sure that the person is not let off at their trial, would be wishing at least that they had the boldness to shoot the accused. But that's not the system that we go by. Our civilization says a person must be tried, and they mustn't be killed for any crime until it's been proved in a trial. You'd be interested to know, I think, and the listeners, that there's much more murdering in the United States than there is in any other Western nation that we know of. And I think that this comes from such things as the amount of violence and brutality on television, and the amount of violence and brutality in movies, and children while they're growing up, who see on the average of 18,000 murders per year, it's natural that children get the idea that this is one of the normal ways that you solve problems. So I think that one of the answers, to me, the most important one, is that children, that movie makers and television producers should be presenting worthwhile problems, constructive programs for children, so they wouldn't have to be watching brutality, most of it, to be sure, pretend brutality, but young children can't tell the difference very well.
This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. My guest is Dr. Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor. Let's talk to Stanley in Sacramento. Stanley, you're on with Dr. Benjamin Spock. Hello, Stanley.
Hello, I'm on the air. I have a couple of questions for Dr.
Quiet,
Spock.
Mary.
Speakerphone. Do you hear me?
Stanley, please get off the speakerphone and get on a regular phone.
I'm sorry, I had it on speakerphone. Do you hear me now?
Well, you're just fine.
Okay. First, I'd like to say, Dr. Spock, I had my first child in 1948. I was 25 years old. I didn't know anything about child raising. Your book was very, very helpful. I still remember parts of it, and they're indelibly in my mind.
You don't need
me to tell you this, but I just felt I had to. I had a couple of questions. One of them is...
Just give me one at a time, because the second one will drive the first one out of my mind.
All right. Okay, I'm sorry. First one is, Dr. McDougall is on a vegan vegetarian diet, which is excellent.
I can't speak a little more slowly and a little louder, please.
Dr. McDougall's diet is a vegan vegetarian diet, and I understand that you have kind of moved over to a macrobiotic diet.
That's right.
Which is very similar to Dr. McDougall's diet.
Right.
Except that it has some additions. And I would like you to comment on that, and also let me know if you had any personal experience where you had some results from a macrobiotic diet, or where you had seen other people have good results.
Okay, Stanley, I'll relay those questions to him. Dr. Spock, the question is a vegan diet, let's say a macrobiotic-type diet, is this a diet that would be okay for children, say, after they get off a normal period of breastfeeding?
Yes, I think it would be a good diet for children. I think quite an increasing number of children are, at the parents' urging, moved over onto such a diet. I hadn't planned my own converging.
Yeah, why did you? Here you are, you're a man, I imagine, that was raised on the American diet for most of his life, and now, I guess at the urging of your younger wife, you are a vegan. You follow a macrobiotic type of diet, and there must have been some benefits you've seen from such a radical change.
Well, I didn't know too much about it when I started, but there were two big problems. One was, the main one was that at the age of 88, I was having more and more bronchitis. And for an old person to get severe bronchitis that requires medication, serious medication, that was one of the main things that was wrong with my health.
And did it help? Did your diet?
What happened was that in the previous 11 months, I'd had constant bronchitis with fever. After getting on the macrobiotic diet, I didn't have one cold for 11 months after that.
Dr. Spock, we need to hold you right here for just a moment. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. My guest is Dr. Benjamin Spock, and there are lines open for you at 707-270-1350. And good morning. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network, and it's a real privilege for me to have the chance to talk to Dr. Benjamin Spock today. And Dr. Spock was just relating to us the fact that he had recurrent bronchitis, quite a serious problem for a man 88 years old. And once he changed to a vegan diet, it got better. Dr. Spock, I would challenge you with the fact that that was eliminating all the dairy products that made the difference. Would you argue?
Well, certainly it's one of the basic things about a macrobiotic diet. I thought that we ought to mention, for those who are not familiar with the term, that it's a vegetarian diet with the addition that you're not meant to eat any dairy food at all. This goes beyond vegetarian. No milk, no cream, no butter, none of the sauces made with butter, so that it's really quite drastic.
What you're living on
mainly is cereals and vegetables with the addition of some beans. And it's been found that will provide all the essential things in a diet.
Dr. Spock, you shouldn't salivate when you mention butter and ice cream and cheese and things like that. You give yourself away. Let me. You are going to also say something about another illness that it helped you with when you changed to a macrobiotic diet. You mentioned the bronchitis. Was there something else that changed? Did you lose weight?
Well,
did you feel better?
I was beginning to get a little bit fat in the abdomen, not badly so, but in spite of trying to hold down a little on my diet. After I'd been on the macrobiotic diet for 6 or 8 weeks, I'd lost 30 pounds without trying. I wasn't trying to lose weight, but it just came shedding off. So those two things impressed me very much, that it put an absolute end to the tendency to bronchitis, and two, that it could produce that strong an effect on weight that when you're not even trying to lose weight, you lose 30 pounds. Altogether, I lost 50 before I stopped losing.
That's amazing. Dr. Spock, you see the sanity in eating well. You are a man who's been involved in human health and the welfare of human beings for your whole life. As a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, you were also involved in the nuclear war issue.
Yes, especially I was opposed. I was in favor, strongly in favor of nuclear disarmament, but also in ending the war in Vietnam.
Right. So you've been very concerned about humanitarian issues for a long time. With your perspective, with your many years of thinking about the situation and how human beings act and react, what do you think the chances are that sanity in terms of good health, in terms of proper nutrition, will ever pervade in American society? Are we going to win this war or not in terms of getting parents to understand how to feed their children and how to feed themselves?
Well, nutritionists, I think, all agree that in America, where we have the opportunity to have the most marvelous varied diet, that a majority of Americans are on a poor diet, eating much too much fat, eating too much fried potatoes and potato chips,
But we know this, and you and I know the solution is a vegan kind of diet to feed our older children and our and adults, you know, once children get off the breast milk. We know that. Lots of other scientists know that. But my question is, from a man of great experience, is it ever going to happen with the economy the way it is, with food industry the way it is, with people's gluttonous appetites the way they're trained? Is it ever going to happen? Are we going to see a significant change like we did with cigarette smoking, where 30 years ago it was socially acceptable to smoke? Today it's a disgusting habit, and a smoker is a social outcast. Will that happen with food?
Well, I think that there will be a tendency toward a more and more healthy, sensible diet. When you come around to another question, will we ever get to a real disarmament and an end to a hatred between nations? I think that that's a more dubious one, and I think that that's going to destroy us unless we do get rid of the arms and learn that it's absolutely essential for us to make friends with each other throughout the world.
Well, we want to make sure that people are friendly at their dinner plate, too. This is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. My guest is Dr. Benjamin Spock. Let's go to another call. We have Dick in Chico. Dick, you're on with Dr. Benjamin Spock.
Yes, Dr. Spock, I brought up your name yesterday, last night, in a conversation I was having with a friend, and I caught myself not really being able to finish because I wasn't sure that I was quoting you right. So I have two questions. One is, that day that you had the news conference on milk, I came away from that a little disappointed, and I guess I'm not real straight on your position. I appreciate the fact that people were talking about the dangers of milk, but it seemed like you pulled back and were not taking a real strong position that milk is an unfit food for people. Is that a true statement?
Well, obviously a tremendous majority of Americans, for instance, have grown up with cow's milk, and most of them have turned out to be healthy. So there's no point trying to scare the bejeebers out of everybody. On the other hand, there's no doubt that allergies, including colic, and maybe some other diseases, including diabetes, that one factor may be milk. So I think you're torn as an educator of the public. How do you say it? You don't want to scare all the people or make them feel guilty. On the other hand, you want to tell them what's wise. And I tried to be a little on the cautious side in that press conference because several of the other speakers were making rather alarmist-sounding remarks.
This is Dr. John McDougall. Dr. Spock and I will be back with you in just a few moments.
Member FDIC.
Good morning, this is Dr. John McDougall on the Northern California Radio Network. My guest is Dr. Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor, and we have on with Dr. Spock Dick from Chico. And Dick, I understand your point. One thing I want to ask Dr. Spock before we get back to you, Dick, is, Dr. Spock, even though you said these representatives that were making the statement at the press conference were extreme in their recommendation,
more extremist way than I would like to do myself.
Yep. But the question is, were they wrong?
It wasn't true. It was that they were leaning heavily on the more alarming aspects and not bothering with the reassurance.
I understand. But in other words, you're not saying they were wrong about their concerns. You just felt that you didn't want to scare people.
Right.
Okay. Dick, was there another question you had?
Well, I guess that's left a lot of people confused, including myself, to the point where I couldn't finish the conversation last night without checking to find out what you did say. I didn't want to misrepresent your position, but because you are so respected, you're so widely read, the words that you say carry an awful lot of weight with people.
That's right. That's why I was so careful.
Well, yeah, but when you drew back there, I detected that, and I said, oh, wait a minute. He doesn't believe that there's a problem with milk to the degree that it is. And as we look through the research...
Oh, I said very specifically that some infants and some children get into trouble with milk, and that it's not right to say therefore, that every child must drink a quart of milk per day. There are hundreds of thousands of Americans of either African or Asian background who are quite intolerant to the milk.
Well, I guess my concern, and I'd like to leave you with this thought, is because of you having entered the discussion on the area of milk, people are looking to you now, you know, they're putting a lot of weight on what you say. I would encourage you to re-examine the evidence and see that you've benefited from going to a strictly vegetarian diet, and I would encourage you to encourage other people to do it too, and the scientific research is there to support that position, because the animal products are causing problems in people's health, and I think you can do a lot to encourage people to move in that direction and receive the same benefit that you have. Thank you.
And Dr. Spock, you've never been one to hold back, and so if you see the truth out there, I'm sure you're going to react in a direction that will be beneficial to all those people you care about. Let's talk to Julie in Sacramento. Julie, you're on with Dr. Benjamin Spock. Julie, you have to listen to the telephone. Hey, Julie.
Hi, I have...
Go ahead. Yes, you're on with Dr. Spock. Turn off your radio and listen to the phone.
I have 9-month-old twin boys, and my question is about sleeping through the night. I breastfed them for 6 months. They're now eating 3 times a day, and they're waking up at 2:30 and 4:30 every night, and they wake each other up. I'm not sure if I should put them in separate rooms or feed them more, or what's the best thing
to do? How do you get a child to sleep through the night, Dr. Spock?
Well, one thing is not being in too much of a hurry to rush in when you hear them stirring. I think especially with the first child, or in this case perhaps twins, that the tendency of the very dedicated mother or father is every time they hear the baby stirring in the baby's sleep that they rush in. And I think you ought to assume that the baby will go back to sleep and not rush in on a very slight whimper. On the other hand, if your child really is crying, and this is not something that the child has done before, of course you have to go in, try to find out what's the matter. So what I'm saying is particularly that if the problem has been getting worse for weeks and months, the child waking earlier and earlier and demanding to be walked or have company, then it's worthwhile being a little bit hard-hearted. Now, what will happen is that the first night, the child, I think it's good for the mother to give a talk to the children or the father and say, kiddo, you need your sleep, I need my sleep. So from tonight on, I'm not going to come in just because I hear you stirring. This is not that a 9-year-old understands every word, but it helps the parent come to a resolution. I must do the sensible thing. And usually there's not more than 10 to 20 minutes fussing the first night, and 10 minutes the second night, 5 to 10 minutes the second night. And usually by the third night, there's not even a wakefulness. And so many parents have told me, oh, I think of all the months of being up with these babies to realize that it wasn't really necessary. This has encouraged me to say to parents, you must be kind-hearted in general if you see that the situation is getting to be more and more, cause more and more difficulty at night. You may have to just not go in.
Well, Julia, okay. Just if I can summarize for you, he said, let them cry. They'll get used to it. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, but I don't want it to be expressed quite that strictly, because then the word gets around. Spock says don't let a child...
Well, no, McDougall said that. I just interpreted Dr. Spock. Let's talk to Stephanie in Windsor. This is Dr. John McDougall with Dr. Benjamin Spock. Stephanie, you're on with Dr. Benjamin Spock.
Yes, I had a question about iron deficiency. I'm on the McDougall diet, and I'm breastfeeding my... She's almost 9 months. and she had a blood test, and they said it was a little bit low in iron, and I was wondering, is that normal for somebody that's on a vegetarian-type diet?
Did you follow that, Dr. Spock? She's breastfeeding the child. Breastfed babies usually don't have a problem with iron deficiency, do they? Dr. Spock? The question is...
Certainly there is a tendency for babies during the latter half of the first year to become slightly anemic. In most cases, it's not severe anemia. I think you need to check with the doctor how anemic and does some special is special iron medication necessary.
So, Stephanie, check with your doctor. Unfortunately, we're running short on time. Dr. Spock, I tell you, I enjoyed your statements and the stand that you were able to give in terms of at least letting parents know that milk is not absolutely necessary. And I look forward to seeing how things develop. You are a man who stands up for what's right and wrong, and I think that as time goes on, you'll be able to express your personal life in your professional life a little more and encourage more people to become vegans.
Well, I'll always do what I think is right.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Spock. This is Dr. John McDougall. I look forward to joining you tomorrow.